All right, we are recording. Just check my things.
Oh, there we go.
You all right?
Yeah, all set. Couldn't find my notes. Winging it.
All right. Okay, shall we begin? May as well. You know, suppose we've let the folks at home dilly-dally long enough. Hey, you, and welcome. My name is Mike, and welcome. I said it again. I always do that. I'm like, hey, you, and welcome is my catchphrase.
Yeah, yeah.
But then I'm also like, oh, but also... welcome.
Welcome.
Yeah, welcome back to another episode of the That Chapter podcast. I'm joined, as you probably guessed, by my frequent collaborator, Mr. Keith.
Hoi.
Dirty Keith, Big K, Special K, whatever you want to call him. He answers to them all.
I do, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, he's not a picky man. he's sitting across from me. He's got his glasses on, his long hair flowing. Mm-hmm. He's got his tattoos showing. He's got his Misfits t-shirt on. Keith, what kind of bands do you like? You know, the folks at home are curious.
What kind of bands? Well, the Misfits. I like them. I think I mentioned it before in the podcast. Definitely still like all-time favorite bands. Probably Billy Talent.
Mr. Oh, Billy Talent himself.
Yeah, it's just one guy. No, love Billy Talent. It kind of goes to what we were saying the last episode where I'm just gone back to listening to all the like bands teenage years. I've been listening to... I've been following Billy Talent since I was 14, 15. I think they were one of my first gigs. But
Very good. Interesting.
Yeah, very, very good.
Yeah, going back to your youth. You're revisiting your youth.
Yeah, yeah. Trying to feel young again, mentally. But,
While you aged decrepitly. All right, folks. Well, here, listen. Welcome back to part two of the Beltway Snipers, the DC Snipers, the two... Dickheads, I think they're called them.
That's
what we're calling them. Before we get into it, Keith, last time, on the last episode of the podcast, you told a very, dare I say, frightening story. I peed myself. I don't know if you noticed it, but I noticed it.
I didn't want to say that, but...
Thankfully, you didn't. So, your wife heard a mysterious person with your voice calling for her.
Yep.
But it was not you.
No, it
was
me.
Someone else.
Yeah.
The ghost.
Somebody called my wife, and she answered, and they replied back, come here. So she went out to investigate. She thought it was me calling. Came up. It was not me.
No.
Someone in the house, something in the house, was calling her.
So are you guys, like, getting really freaked out here, or, like...
I'm loving it.
Yeah, the content.
Yeah, oh my God, the content. But from the start, I've been saying, like, there's some weird things happening. She goes, shut up, you know.
Yeah.
It's grand, like, but now she's... I think she's at a turning point now. Yeah, because she's seen the thing with the door. That was weird. She's like, can't explain that. And now this thing where something's calling her. And she's like, I still can't explain that. Don't know. I think she's becoming a believer as well.
She was the Dana Scully to your Fox Mulder. And now she too is becoming... It's two Fox Mulders. You got two Fox Mulders. You know? All right. This is weird. Wacky stuff. You know, I've never experienced the ghost or a ghoul in my entire life. And I'm pretty jealous.
Like, I still haven't... seen the ghost. I'd love to see a ghost. That'd be great. That'd
I
be
never
awesome.
Even experienced anything unexplained. Not that I can remember anyway.
Right, yeah. We definitely had a couple of unexplained stuff now happen in the house, which I've mentioned, but maybe when you come over, man, and we're doing the old pod up in the attic.
Yes, in February, probably late February, we'll be recording a live episode. Well, not a live episode, like a video episode. I mean, we could do it live, but like the hassle of that. No, honestly.
God knows what it takes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we do need one of those old editors to come in and maybe just snip that out. I don't want to get canceled. People do listen to this after all.
Yeah.
But hey, listen. Potty mouth Keith over here would never say anything bad.
Oh, yeah, it's on me.
All right. Let's get into today's topic. The DC Snipers Part 2. In Part 1, we talked about Lee Malvo and John Muhammad.
Mm-hmm.
Not related, but I mean, they're essentially a father-son relationship. John Muhammad's brainwashing. Poor Lee. I mean, you won't be saying poor Lee for long. What are you doing? And the pair of them then, long story short, traveled around America from Washington to Georgia to Louisiana to New Jersey, just shooting people. Yeah. Almost completely at random. Most of the time it was random. They robbed a few of them, but very few of the murders were financially motivated.
Yeah.
Most of them was just popping off shots.
Yeah. And at this point in the story, still the police haven't kind of put together that all those incidents are related yet.
Yeah, because they've been happening just all across the country. There's no pattern to it. It wasn't in any particular geographic area. It was everywhere.
Yeah, they just thought it was these random shootings that happened. And I guess because like it's different states and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Different jurisdictions and they weren't sharing...
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And they didn't really leave much evidence behind. Most of the shots were from long range, so it wasn't, very few witnesses. I think only one of the people was able to give an accurate description.
Just one.
Semi-accurate description.
Yeah.
But
also, the people that they were shooting as well were...
Did you just interrupt me?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Continue. I'll allow it this time. Don't do it again.
Wasn't even good what I was going to say.
Okay.
I was going to say, even the people are random. There's no rhyme or reason.
Well, Keith, I hope you learned your lesson. This is what happens when you interrupt me. All right. Well, here, listen, in part two, which is you're listening to it, all the attacks are geographically linked.
Mm.
And this is when the shit hits the fan, my friends. The absolute insanity that was October 2002 began in Montgomery County, Maryland, when on the 2nd of that month, which would be October 2nd, 2002, at around 5:20 p.m., someone, wink, wink, took a potshot at a Michael's Craft store in Aspen Hill, a small suburban town. Luckily, no one was hit that time, but the same can't be said for another shooting just an hour later. The second shooting took place just a 9-minute drive away in Wheaton when 55-year-old James D. Martin was shot as he walked past a Shoppers food warehouse. Another completely random victim in the wrong place at the worst possible time. James was a program analyst at the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, basically a government scientist. He was at the supermarket just buying groceries for his church, and he died in the parking lot after being shot by Muhammad and Malvo.
At this time, the two shootings so close to each other in time and space, some police officials, they did start to suspect something was up, but they just couldn't say for sure. They just they were like, maybe they're related, but we're not sure. But I also think that it's worth noting that when this series of sniper attacks began, the American nation was very much on edge. People, they were still grappling from the 9/11 attacks, which happened only a year before. So when people started being killed at random from an unknown sniper in the nation's capital, people were once again on high alert, thinking that this was a new case of terrorism. I'm sure the fact that this also received 24/7 news coverage for 3 weeks didn't alleviate any panic either.
Yeah.
Sure, only 1 week after the 9/11, there was that anthrax attack. And then there was also public concerns that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, including bioweapons. So it's completely understandable. People were on the lookout for another terrorist attack, and tensions were sky high when these sniper attacks began.
Right, absolutely. The next day, on October 3rd, 2002, that was the bloodiest day of the spree, with five people being added to the rapidly growing list of victims. First was 39-year-old James L. Sonny Buchanan Jr., less than 7 miles from the previous day's shooting of James D. Martin. Buchanan Jr. was a business law graduate of the University of Maryland and the son of a retired Montgomery County police officer. He was extremely active in his volunteering at the local Boys and Girls Club, where he loved teaching the youngsters the garden. All anyone had to say about him was how big his heart was and how kind he could be. He ran a lawn care business and was mowing the lawn of a customer's car dealership near Rockville, Maryland, when he was shot dead by Muhammad and Malvo. 54-year-old Prem Kumar Walakar was pumping gas into his taxi at a gas station in Aspen Hill, 6 miles from where Buchanan was shot, and not far from where a gunshot had been fired at a Michael's Craft store a day earlier. It was his 25th wedding anniversary, and he'd been rushing to try and finish his shift early in order to get home and enjoy the day, but of course he'd never make it back. 8 miles away in Silver Springs, 34-year-old nanny and housekeeper Sarah Ramos was next. She was shot as she sat on a bench, reading, outside a post office not far from a quiet retirement community. She left behind her husband and her 7-year-old son.
At this point, the police, they started receiving reports as well from witnesses who'd said that they'd seen a white panel truck in the area of the shooting. So the police, they were on high alert looking for this.
Exactly.
But obviously, when you say like so many white panel trucks,
it's
when you say, oh, it was a white truck, you start seeing white trucks everywhere.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, it's crazy. Like, this is how many victims in just one morning? You're just random bang, bang, bang. The last victim of the morning, but not the day, was a 25-year-old Idaho native named Lori Ann Lewis Rivera. Just like Prem Walakar, Lori was shot at a gas station while vacuuming her car, 20 minutes away from where Sarah Ramos was shot, and around 15 minutes from the gas station where Prem was killed. Another innocent and completely random victim, leaving a small daughter and devastated husband behind. Later in the evening, the final victim of the day, retired carpenter, 72-year-old Haitian immigrant Pascal Charlotte. He was shot and killed while he was walking along the intersection of Georgia Avenue Northwest and Kalmia Road Northwest in the nation's capital. He was walking to the bus station when he was chosen at random. He was married with 5 children and had immigrated to the US from Haiti more than 30 years earlier.
It was pretty obvious to the police at this point that the shooting and the two from yesterday, they were all linked. They had also started receiving new reports about what the killer had been driving, which contradicted the report about the white panel truck they received earlier in the day. Witnesses, they'd now said that they'd seen a dark, older model Ford or Chevrolet Caprice, Unfortunately, this new description of the truck was ignored by the police, and they continued looking for a white panel truck.
Yeah, I mean, I can just imagine the pure confusion. They just didn't know what to look for.
Yeah, just
you know, could literally be anything.
That's it, yeah.
Less than 24 hours later, on October 4th, 2002, and almost 55 miles away from the final shooting on October 3rd, an unidentified 43-year-old woman was shot outside a mall in Fredericksburg, Virginia. Though she was apparently in critical condition, she ultimately survived her injuries and was later released from hospital. There seemed to be no barrier to being a victim of the Beltway snipers, with the assassins willing to cross every line imaginable. Gender, location, none of it mattered. All of their victims were pretty much chosen at random.
The news started to spread here as well that there was an active spree killer on the loose. So the chief of police, Montgomery County, Charles Moose, he held a press conference and gave a statement which informed parents that schools were on a code blue alert, which kept children indoors. But he'd also said schools were safe. Horrifically, though, what happens next nearly seems to be a direct response to the statement from the snipers.
Yeah.
As a way to say, no one's safe.
Yeah, yeah. You're all going to get it. It was on October 7th, 2002, that the gunmen crossed another line when they shot 13-year-old Aaron Brown just after 8 a.m. as his aunt was in the process of dropping him off in the parking lot of Benjamin Tasker Middle School in Bowie, Maryland. His aunt, who was a hero, rushed Brown straight to the nearest emergency room, where he was airlifted to another hospital and underwent emergency surgery to remove part of his spleen and repair damage to his internal organs. In total, he was hospitalized for several weeks with severe injuries, but in the end, with youth on his side, he made a full recovery. Brown went on to testify against Muhammad during his October 2003 trial. Not far from where Iran was shot, police made another discovery. A death tarot card. On the front of it was scrawled, "Call me God," and on the reverse was a message to the police reading, "For your Mr. Police, code, call me God. Do not release to the press."
This was a huge turning point in the investigation for the police. It was a message directly from the sniper suggesting that they wanted to contact them in the future. So it was incredibly important to the police that this information was not shared with the press, because once everyone knew the code, call me God, its value as a communication tool would be completely ruined.
Right.
And the police, they did an amazing job at keeping this information secret. For about a day.
Yeah, everyone is.
The information about the card was leaked to the press the very next day, and it was reported on multiple TV stations and the Washington Post newspaper. It was pretty clear also that the leak came from inside by someone on the task force. But the chief of police, Charles Moose, he was furious about this leak. And at another press conference, he tore into the media for sharing this information with the public. He got real passive aggressive with it as well.
Yeah.
He was like, "Look, if anyone from the media wants to solve this case, just let me know and we will turn the case over to you."
Yeah.
We have lots of other police work to do, so
yeah,
go ahead and solve it yourself.
Yeah.
This was a pretty tactical response, to be fair. It was clear the sniper was watching the news. After he took what Chief Moose said at the last press conference about school children being safe is nearly like a challenge. So by having it out with the media like this, he was making it pretty clear he did not want this leak to happen, and he still wants to open up a line of communication, have some sort of dialogue with the killer. So pretty smart move on Chief Moose's part, I think.
Yeah, the Moose doing good. The next two victims were split across the 9th and 10th of October 2002, and both took place at Muhammad and Malbo's favorite stomping ground, the gas station. It's no understatement at all to say that people were genuinely scared shitless to do just a perfectly normal thing like pump gas.
Those guys with the red berets came out, the Guardian Angels. They came out to help people pump gas, so they'd let people stay in their car and they'd come and they'd pump gas for
who?
Them. Do you know the guys with the red berets? They're like...
I have no idea who you're talking about. Red berets?
I'll show you a photo. These guys. Have you seen them?
No. I've never seen them before in my life. The Guardian Angels? That's what they're called?
It's like a...
They're like a biker gang?
No, it's like an organization, but they're like non-confrontational organization.
Oh,
they don't carry weapons around that stuff.
So what do they do? Just go around helping people?
Yeah,
all right.
Pretty much, yeah.
Never. Okay. Hey, listen. I learned something new, which means we all learned something new today, folks. 53-year-old Vietnam veteran and Purple Heart Award winner Dean Harold Myers was killed at a Sunoco service station in Prince William County, Virginia. After being left permanently disabled due to enemy action in the war, Myers graduated from Penn State with a degree in civil engineering in 1975. Philly businessman and community activist 53-year-old Kenneth Hay Bridges was shot dead 36 hours later and 9:30 a.m., 60 miles away at a Spotsylvania County gas station on the 10th of October 2002. Despite a uniformed state trooper being less than 50 yards away and hearing the gunshot and responding quickly, little could be done for Kenneth Bridges.
At first, they thought that the shots were coming from rooftops, but as they checked out the bullet angles, it turns out that they were fired from the ground level, making them consider the idea that the sniper might have been shooting from a vehicle. Mm. And this also led them to think that there might have been a pair of shooters. At this point, they still only thought there was one shooter. Mm-hmm. So they thought there might have been a pair instead of just one lone gunman. One person doing the shooting and another acting as a getaway driver.
Right.
Law enforcement, they did develop a profile of the sniper, but they didn't have much confidence in it, so they never released it to the public. But initially they thought it might have been a man and a woman, with the man being the dominant, taking the shots, and the woman acting as the getaway driver. Honestly, they were completely stumped and they had no idea who they were dealing with at this point. They were so desperate that they brought in a psychic to the investigation.
I love when they bring in psychics. It's like, oh, I'm really scraping the bottom of the barrel here now, folks.
Apparently they bring them in a lot.
Yeah.
The psychic detective that was brought in was called Pam Coronado, and she's quite the resume. She has consulted as a psychic detective to large and small police departments, state and federal, international and private agencies. She did get a couple of things correct in the case. She sensed that there was two males. One was older and kind of like a father figure. Mm-hmm. And she also sensed that they were trying to be as random as possible to throw off the police. I'll be honest, I think a lot of the psychic stuff is like horseshit and there's like so many charlatans out there.
Yeah.
But I listened to an interview with Pam and she seems lovely and quite genuine, wants to help people. So I still don't believe in it. However, even if there is like what she's saying does helps the detectives look at it from a different angle, mm-hmm. in order to like solve it, like I guess that helps. So yeah, good for you, Pam.
She could get like a probably more reputable career, maybe be like a criminal profiler or something. Like she probably has like the skills of like, or is naturally just good at developing psychological. I mean, probably most of these psychics are actually just naturally good at psychological profiling people, and maybe they just, it's through the cards.
Yeah,
it's like,
yeah.
You know, you're probably just good at psychology.
You're picking up on little things and you're kind of piecing together.
It's like, it's not the cards. Yeah, so yeah. It's like, you're just, maybe she should have just gotten a job as a criminal profiler. And it's like, okay, then you could actually probably say the same things. A lot of it's bullshit.
Yeah.
But you know, at least it's reputable.
Have a bit more weight to it.
Exactly. Mm. Exactly. Mm. And the police wouldn't look so freaking stupid for involving psychics. Which is weird because they do come up a lot.
They do. And that was from the interview that I heard with Pam. She was saying that like, the police, they really do work a lot with these psychics. It's not something that they put out publicly because...
For good reason.
For good reason. One, they don't like it. It sounds so silly, but also they don't want to be inundated with calls. I'm a psychic too.
Ooh, well, I like, feel it.
Like Pam, she didn't insert herself into the investigation. She was invited in.
Wow.
So they invite a lot of these psychics in to help them out with it.
Weird.
Yeah.
Okay,
super
weird.
Interesting. Yeah,
well, hey, listen.
There could be an episode there with psychic detectives.
Psychic detectives. That sounds like a bad TV show.
I would totally.
Can we start have our own? We can be like, or do our own show, Psychic Detectives.
We should. I would watch that.
I'm doing the, for the folks at home,
he's
doing
fingering himself.
I'm doing the Professor X motion with my fingers against my head. For the record, I'm doing a Professor X motion. All right. 47-year-old Linda Franklin, an FBI intelligence operations specialist, was fatally shot outside a Home Depot in Fairfax County on October 14, 2002, as herself and her husband, William, were loading up their car in the parking lot. William stood close enough to his wife when she was shot that he literally felt her blood hit him in the face before she collapsed to the ground. Malvo would later be overheard describing the reason he shot Linda Franklin as being because, quote, she was being lazy, just standing there.
This is an interesting... here goes the finger.
No, the point is that, folks.
The police, they actually received a really promising tip during this shooting from a man named Matthew M. Dowdy. So Dowdy said that he got a really good look at the shooter and gave a very detailed description of a light-skinned, dark-haired, mustachioed man driving a cream-coloured van with a burnt-out taillight. He also said that the gun he was using was an AK-74 with a silencer. Mm-hmm. However, 2 days after the shooting, Dowdy's story started to unravel when a Fairfax detective, he watched the tapes from Home Depot's security cameras and saw Dowdy inside the store at the time of the shooting. So, it was all complete horseshit. He made up the whole thing just to get his 15 minutes of fame. And for this stupid stunt, by sending the police on a wild goose chase, he got 6 months in jail and a $1,000 fine. good enough for you.
Yeah, yeah, that's well deserved for being a piece of shit. During, like, yeah. I mean, this has been going on for like a long time at this point. Random people being shot, everybody terrified. It's like, yeah. Hey, listen, folks, I got a real fucking good look at it. Like, just pulling it out of your arse.
Ah, he completely threw a spanner in the works of the open investigation. And he threw him off for like 2 days. It was mad. Yeah. But the police, like, after that, they were really desperate for leads. Mm-hmm. But their prayers were answered. On October 15th, the killers, they called the Rockville Police Department in Rockville, Maryland. And the killers gave the code, "Call Me God," and explained that they were the ones killing people. And what did the dispatcher do? She said that they'd reached the wrong department and they needed to ring the hotline instead. So they hung up.
That's not my job. That is not my job.
That is the epitome of not my job, not my problem.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in reality, it was your job and it was your problem.
Oh my God, that is amazing.
Yeah. Unbelievable.
Yeah. Oh, that's gas. All right. Well, 5 days would pass with no further casualties, but the fear of being a victim was still in everyone's minds. It didn't take long before that fear became another innocent person's reality. This brief respite ended on October 19th, 2002, when 37-year-old Jeffrey Hopper was shot and wounded as he was walking out of the Ponderosa restaurant in Ashton, Virginia. Investigators found shell casings at the scene and a note nailed to a tree nearby, accusing police of being inept and demanding $10 million or there would be more killings. The final victim fell on October 22nd, 2002. That was 35-year-old bus driver Conrad E. Johnson, and he was shot dead in Aspen Hill. Police discovered a second threatening letter nearby, again demanding money to stop the shootings. Conrad had been standing on the steps of his bus when he was hit.
The killers, the note they left, first of all, it was riddled with spelling errors, but the note said, "For you, Mr. Police, call me God, do not release to the press. You did not respond to the message. You departed from what you were told to say, and you departed from the time. Your incompetence has cost you yet another life. You have until 9 a.m. to deliver the money and 8 a.m. to deliver the response. We have caught the sniper like a duck in a noose. So let us know you have our demands." And I know what you're thinking. What the hell is he talking about with the duck in the noose?
Yeah, I've never heard that phrase before in my life.
And it is. So researchers, they believe he was referring to a Cherokee folktale known as the rabbit, the otter, and duck hunting. The folktale is about a boastful rabbit who was challenged by an otter to capture a duck. So the rabbit manages to slip a noose around the neck of the duck, which then takes off, with the rabbit hanging on for dear life. So the duck flies higher and higher, and finally the rabbit loses grip and it falls into a sycamore tree where it's trapped and soon reduced to eating its own fur. So if that's the story the caller was talking about, it's basically just making fun of the police chasing them.
Okay.
Casting them as the clueless rabbit.
Okay, right. Okay, going with the folktales here. He's a cultured man. All right. It was a very ill-advised phone call from 17-year-old Malvo himself that set the dominoes falling behind the murderous pair. He said he and Muhammad were responsible for an earlier shooting in Montgomery, Alabama, before the DC shooting. A fingerprint was recovered from the scene of that shooting, but there hadn't been any matches in Alabama's system. But it did match a shooting in DC, and entering it into the system, it brought up a previous arrest of Lee Malvo. Now, with a name to check it against, they could finally tie it. Next came Muhammad, who it was actually a lot more straightforward. It was a good old phone call from an army pal of Muhammad's from Tacoma that led to his identification. Of course, they knew him as John Allen Williams, but putting two and two together, it didn't take long once they had Williams' name. Investigators asked the informant if they knew of Muhammad being friends with someone named Lee Boyd Malvo, describing Malvo. Though the friend didn't recognize the name, he did say that the description rang a bell. The informant said it sounded very much like a young guy Muhammad used to tag around with, but they all knew him by his nickname, Sniper. A photograph of Malvo later, and the investigators had a positive ID of both suspects and a firm documented connection between the two prior to the shootings. It didn't take long before investigators identified the 1990 blue Chevy Caprice that had become the duo's makeshift sniper's nest and mobile home. The license plate was released to the press and public, and an APB was put out for the Chevy with the license plate number NDA21Z. It was then only a matter of time before the pair were in handcuffs and the surviving victims could breathe a sigh of relief and sleep soundly knowing their assailants weren't coming back to finish them off. And the families of the dead could begin healing, knowing that justice was coming The pair were actually arrested while sleeping in the car. Mm. Muhammad and Malvo were taken into custody on the 24th of October 2002. A search of the Chevy later, and the pair were banged to rights with Paul LaRufa's Sony Vaio. Good old Sony Vaio laptop being found in the backseat of the Chevy, along with multiple guns used in the shootings and plenty of ammunition. There was a hole cut in the back of the Chevy, just below the opening of the trunk, big enough for a rifle barrel to be held up and the victim sighted in. So one person would, I guess, sit in the driver's seat and another person would lie down in the back of the car with the gun aimed out the back of the trunk and they'd shoot from the rear. One of the more innocuous seeming discoveries was the owner's manual of the Chevy, which police later discovered had an imprint of one of the notes left behind at the scene of one of the shootings. Malvo had used the manual to rest on it while he wrote, inadvertently leaving the impression of a note that tied the men to the scene and that they had written the note.
It was a bit risky releasing the suspect names and their car license plate number to the press and public.
Yeah.
The killers, they could have easily heard this on the news and then ditched the car and be gone in the wind. But the gamble, it did pay off. I think it was all down to timing because they held the news press conference at 11:50 p.m. And it only took about an hour before they got a call regarding the car meeting the description. And when the SWAT team showed up, as you said, Muhammad and Malvo, they were fast asleep in the car.
Yeah.
And they were completely unaware. They had no idea that there was an APB out for them.
Yeah. I mean, I think just because so many people were being shot and it was so random, they were just like, it's worth the risk. We have to get these people as quickly as possible.
Yeah. It's like, we need to do something.
Yeah. Muhammad stood trial in October 2003 for the shooting of Dean Harold Myers at a gas station on October 9th, 2002, near Manassas, Virginia. The trial was moved from Prince William County to Virginia Beach, just under 200 miles away. Though the trial was for that specific shooting, and there was plenty more, prosecutors included evidence from all 16 of the shootings as they really wanted to execute him. The jury heard from several survivors, as well as William Franklin, whose wife, Linda, was the FBI analyst who was killed in a Home Depot parking lot. Jurors were left in shock after William's 911 call was played and a photograph of Linda was shown to them. Circuit Court Judge Leroy F. Millett Jr. had to give a warning to the courtroom before the pictures were shown. She'd been hit in the face and an entire side of her face had essentially been blown off. William, a former Marine, managed to keep his cool as he recounted what happened that day in distressing detail. In the end, John Muhammad was convicted and was awaiting sentencing to find out if he'd be executed. Which, folks, no prize for guessing how that went. 4 months after being convicted for Dean Harold Myers' murder on March 9th, 2004, Muhammad was sentenced to death. On May 6th, 2006, it was made public that Muhammad had apparently asked his legal counsel to cease all appeals related to his conviction and the death sentence. In his words, to, quote, so he can murder this innocent black man, end quote, which is like...
such a victim mentality. Isn't
yeah,
it?
Exactly, yeah. Amazing how much crazy one person can carry on with them. Hmm. The sentence was carried out on November 10th, 2009 by lethal injection. Now, a death sentence was always likely in this case, with some of the crimes being committed in Virginia. Virginia is second place behind Texas when it comes to the old, you know, the old death execution people thingy. And for those interested, his last meal, John Mam's last meal, was chicken with red sauce and cake.
In fairness, I think if I was on death row, my last meal would be a bottomless brunch.
Ooh, yeah, that's good. I'd
just spend the rest of my day sipping mimosas.
That's good. Yeah. That's good. My last meal would be a key. I want to eat the key to my cell.
I want to eat the cell and the front door.
Yeah. That's it. So I can swallow the key and let myself out. That's right.
But then you need to wait.
What?
If you swallow the key, you need to wait.
I want to have the key and laxatives.
Okay, there we go.
Well, that makes
more sense.
Figure it all out. Or no, I want to eat a gun so I can kill everybody before they kill me. That's it. He also received 6 life sentences from a Maryland jury for the 6 counts of murder. I mean, he did get life sentences, but his life wasn't too long. The shootings were considered an act of terrorism, hence the qualification for the death penalty, despite Virginia's trigger man law, which says Muhammad must have been the one to have actually pulled the trigger in the case. But this time only Malvo's prints were found on the rifle, though Muhammad's DNA was found, so regardless, they were terrorist acts. He could just as easily have been the shooter for many of these cases. Who knows? It was on December 18th, 2003, that Malvo was convicted of two charges, and he was later convicted of a lot more murders. He was sentenced to multiple life sentences without parole. He's currently serving four life sentences in Red Onion State Prison in Southwest Virginia. Malvo's case has actually been back in the news as recently as 2017. Some of these sentences were overturned by the Supreme Court when they ruled against life sentences for juveniles. As a result, Malvo faced resentencing for several murder convictions in Maryland. The state attorney for Montgomery County has said there is obviously no rush to resentence Malvo given he is locked up in Virginia. Had he not been 17 and a minor at the time of the heinous crimes, he likely would have been given a one-way ticket straight to the hot place, along with his friend and stepfather, kind of, John Muhammad.
There's a couple of different motives that were thrown around. So
for why they did this?
Yeah, when Malvo and Muhammad, when they got busted, the media called their motives unclear, which is spot on. No one seems to know. But people, they speculated about from everything, from ties to Al-Qaeda to a scheme in which they would squeeze a few million bucks out of the US government, which they then apparently used for some grander plan that involved heading up to Canada, recruiting orphaned boys along the way, teaching them to use weapons, and then send them out to commit shootings across the country.
Wow.
So this was definitely one of the more sensationalized theories.
That sounds actually more accurate, though. From what they did, it's like, that doesn't sound far-fetched at all.
Maybe it was on the table. You never know.
Yeah.
It came from
somewhere. Just seems like they were so insane all of this.
I think the most likely cause is that John Muhammad's ex-wife, Mildred, was the ultimate target. Mm. Mildred, she believes that the attacks were designed to confuse police so that when he finally came for her, they would assume that she was just another random victim chosen by the sniper. So I think it could be as simple as that. Muhammad, he was already a very violent man and not all there in the head. And when his wife and kids left him, he just snapped. I guess the truth is that we'll never really know the real reason. Malvo, he was interviewed 10 years after the incident and he was still unable to give a clear explanation of why they did what they did. But I honestly have not, I'm saying that it might have been that with the wife, but then also I'm not sure. It looks like they were close to getting away with it.
Yeah.
And then they kept calling the police.
Yeah, it's that whole thing. I mean, probably just arrogance, they thought they could do whatever they wanted, but also...
Yeah. Maybe they wanted to be caught.
I don't know. It's also because they've traveled around America for so long just shooting random people, but then they just somehow stuck in the DC area. And just if they had just kept going around traveling, who knows if they ever would have been caught, Why did they specifically stick to Washington, D.C. area?
Yeah, yeah.
Because his wife lived back in Washington. Didn't she?
Yeah, she was in Washington, yeah.
Yeah.
That's why she reckons she was the ultimate target for it.
Yeah. So you think, why didn't they just go back to Seattle and then start murdering people? Who knows? Who knows? Yeah. I mean, all in all, they killed 17 people, wounded 10 others in a 10-month shooting spree.
Yeah.
Well, there you go. So that is the story of the DC snipers.
Messed up, man. Messed up.
It's effed in the B, folks. Truly, truly effed in the B. But yeah, just a story of two fucking insane psychopaths who, one's dead now, so hey. But the other person just seemed like they were a brainwashed little man.
Just two lunatics, man.
Yeah. And Lee Boyd Malvo still in prison to this day.
He's never gotten out.
No, thankfully, which is good. All right. Actually, I'm just reading here that on August 30th, 2022, he was denied parole by Virginia's parole board.
Good, the system works.
Yeah, exactly. works for some of us. All right, thank you so much for listening to this part two of the DC Snipers. Folks, me and Keith, we appreciate it a lot. He's given me a wink, and he tells me to wink to you. Specifically you listening this right now. He's giggling a lot of schoolgirl over here. All right, please be sure to check out new episodes of the That Shepherd podcast every single Monday mañana.
Mm-hmm.
Next week, we are talking about... Ooh, I actually don't know what we're going to talk about next week. Probably a serial killer. We have one locked and loaded, ready to go.
Yeah, yeah.
Or maybe something else. Who knows?
Spoilers. Ooh. Get the psychic on the case.
A witch. We're talking about more witches.
We're back on witches.
Matt Hopkins, Patrick. I'm actually wearing a Matthew Hopkins t-shirt right now that he got me for my birthday. I actually love this t-shirt. It's really comfortable and it looks awesome.
It is great. Actually, I think I might buy one myself as well.
You should.
Yeah, it's an awesome
You can be the Matthew Hopkins boys.
Yeah.
Yeah. You just call us the Matthew Hopkins podcast. I love that guy. All right, here, folks. As always, it means a lot to me and it means a lot to Keith. I know it does.
Yep.
So, Keith, final thought of the day. Wow me. I'm ready to be wowed.
I guess if you're a psychic detective, just apply yourself. You can be more. You can be a detective.
I co-signed to the fullest degree, my man. Yes, exactly. Get a real job. become a podcaster. You're like, oh, it's a real job. All right. Thanks, guys. Talk to you soon.
See ya.
Bye.